You're listening to the Autism Weekly podcast. Each week, we share community voices and bring light to stories that increase awareness, acceptance, equity, access, and inclusion. If you haven't already, subscribe to join the Autism Weekly family. I'm your host, Jeff Skibitsky. This week, we're joined by Landa Fox, a BCBA and certified sexual health educator with extensive experience in autism and developmental disabilities. Landa specializes in inclusive sexual health education for autistic and neurodivergent individuals. Today, she'll share vital insights on the importance of this education, effective strategies for parents and caregivers, and how ABA therapy can aid in teaching boundaries and safety. Welcome to the podcast, Landa Fox.
Thank you so much for the invitation. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, this is a topic that oftentimes is not discussed. Even in our research, it's hard to find, and it's one that is pivotal in a neurotypical life or a neurodivergent life. We all have the same sort of concerns, issues, and navigating throughout our lifespan these questions. But before we go that route and get into the details, I'd love to hear about your journey and how you became a BCBA and what brought you into becoming a certified sex health educator.
Yeah, I feel like my story is similar to probably lots of people's stories where, growing up BCBA or behavior analyst or those that like wasn't a career that was kind of on the radar. And so I just kind of fell into it, as I think lots of people in the field do. So I was, during my undergraduate degree, I was in a stream where we did like a co-op placement. So we had to find a job kind of related to our major. And my major was psychology at the time, or it continued to be. That's my undergraduate diploma. And so I was kind of struggling to find a job that fit in the psychology realm. And my co-op advisor said, there's this job that's working in an early intervention program for autistic kids, and I think that you'd be really good at it. And I was like, I don't know. Like I'd never really worked with kids. I didn't do babysitting and like those kinds of things when I was growing up. I was like, I'm not sure about this. But I applied and I got it, and then I just absolutely loved it. Like I loved the kids. I love the families. At that time, we worked a lot in, like, it was in-home services. So I was kind of traveling around and going to different families' homes. And I loved kind of like getting to know them and their individual family situations. And, you know, the fact that people would just welcome you into their home to support them and their child was like astounding to me. And is like so vulnerable for families. So I loved that. And I loved just like, it was like science, but playing. Like I was just like having fun with kids, but there was like a method to it and a science, and and that's kind of how my brain works. And so I just really, really loved it. And I've just, been kind of doing it ever since. And I did a master's degree in special education. And then obviously my BCBA and field work and all of that. And then there was sort of before, you know, speaking of careers that you didn't know were a thing when you were growing up, when I was younger, sort of in like the early or later elementary school age and like later high school, if you asked anybody that I still know or knew me then what they thought I was going to do for work, they probably would have said that I would have been a sexual health educator, because I was really interested in that area. In Canada, and she sort of started to have a presence in the U.S. a bit later. There was a woman whose name was Sue Johansson, and she had something called the Sunday Night Sex Show, which was a radio program and then a TV show eventually. And she was just a great model of somebody who was comfortable kind of asking questions and talking about sexual health topics that people didn't talk about. And I loved her. And so people were like, oh, you're going to be Sue Johansson. And then you don't really kind of know like how to become that when you're younger. Like she was a nurse, and I knew I didn't really want to go into the medical profession. And so I kind of forgot about that until I started really getting into doing more of the work in sort of like autism support, disability support. And I started to see, as I was kind of figuring out where I wanted to focus my like independent practice or places that I wanted to work or communities that I wanted to support, that the people that I was supporting like weren't getting access to that information. And I was like, that's a pretty big gap. I wonder if somebody's filling that gap. And it was kind of, it was pretty hard to find people who were filling that gap. More and more people are doing this work that sort of joins those two things. But when I first sort of started, there wasn't a lot of people, or it was kind of hard to find and connect with folks. And so I was like, well, I guess I'll become a sexual health educator and just kind of become that person. And so that's what I did.
I appreciate that you did that, because I think I agree with you, is that no matter where I have provided service, one of the largest gaps is on tackling sexual health education within the autistic or neurodivergent communities. Now, that being said, what are some of those misconceptions that are out there that oftentimes lead to people not tackling these issues with the autistic community or special ed community or the neurodivergent community in the same way that they might have those conversations with those that maybe identify as neurotypical?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's, well, one, and then I really see this when I'm supporting families in particular, is that they have, especially when kids are younger, although certainly that doesn't change always for people, is that they've got so many things that they're thinking about, right? So many skills that people are telling them, like, your child's behind on this thing, or they need more support with that or the other. And you're trying to navigate like a system of support with like BCBAs and maybe speech pathologists and occupational therapists or physio and all of these professionals. And then you've got your child in a school system, and maybe some of those people are part of the school system, but maybe not. And there's just so much for families to sort of think about around like what's important for them and where they want to focus skill building and stuff for their child, that like sexual health just kind of takes a back seat or doesn't even kind of like come to the front. Because there's so many things that people are working on and thinking about, right? If your child's having difficulty communicating, obviously, you know, you're going to put a lot of time and focus into developing those skills. And so that's one thing. I think it's just, you know, it's another thing for people to think about when they already, families in particular, feel often quite overwhelmed with the care that their child needs and the professionals that their child needs on their kind of care team. Another one, I think, unfortunately, is that we think about people with disabilities, physical disabilities and developmental disabilities, as not having a sexuality, that this kind of doesn't apply to them for whatever reason. I think, you know, people like often use phrases like, well, you know, they're 15, but really they're 5. And it's like, well, you know, I understand why people do that, especially if when they're trying to highlight the challenges that their child has to get them supports and things like that. But it's not helpful when we're thinking about somebody who's 5, but whose body is 15, particularly when it comes to sexual health, puberty, those kinds of things. Disability doesn't impact sexuality in that way, right? People are going to develop and, you know, have those physical changes regardless of sort of where they're at in terms of their reading skills or their language. And so I think that those two things sort of come together to mean that people put it on the back burner and don't really think about it when they're supporting, you know, if you're thinking professionals supporting somebody with a disability, or for families, they're just trying to think about what are the things their kid needs to know about.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you think about that juxtaposition of, you talk to most families and you say, what is it that you'd love to be able to provide for your child? One of the first things that they're going to say is healthy relationships, being able to maintain that close friendship or a relationship that maybe is romantic in their future. And without those skill sets, without empowering it, you almost set it up where there's a lot of risk. There's a lot of opportunity for failure, because some of those areas of disability, and I loosely use the word disability, but some of those areas where there might be some deficits are on understanding social cues, are on being able to engage in some of those social reciprocations. How, and I guess, what aspects of development do you focus on when you're talking about sexual health, when you're working with the autistic community, that might be a little bit more focused or a little bit more heightened in the way that you're addressing issues?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's a good point when you ask people, and I do this a lot, especially when other professionals will often ask me, you know, sort of how do you start these conversations with families who are, you know, presenting as being uncomfortable, or kind of not really open to this topic. And I usually kind of bring it back to like a values question, like you said, of like, what are the things that you know, are important for your child? What do you want for them, you know, in their life? And usually you're right. People say like, I want them to be happy. I want them to have like healthy relationships, like happy, healthy, and safe usually, or like something in one of those kind of categories are pretty common values for all parents to have for their kids. And I think for autistic or neurodivergent disabled families to have the children with those disabilities, for me, it's still those kind of three things. And so usually like, I think that sexual health, and I always say sexual health and sexuality to me as a professional is like a lifelong set of safety and wellness skills is sort of how I frame it. I think that's helpful because then it kind of takes off this idea that sexuality is equal to sex, which is sort of how adults often think about it. But children and youth often are like not thinking about it in those same ways. But if we think about those values, that sort of often guides the skills that I think about as being really important. And so if we think about healthy and safe, you know, often those are skills around things like protecting like body autonomy. So the teaching, I'll say kids, but that includes like children and youth. I know teenagers hate when I call them kids, but anyway, they fit in that category. Kids, teaching them, you know, to say no, have boundaries, to understand that they have a right to say no, particularly when it comes to things about their body. But that can be other things as well. It's like those kind of safety skills. There's some communication skills in there too, right? So things that are as simple as like being able to name or point to or understand the names for private body parts so that people can communicate if something is hurt. You know, if somebody just has like an itchy vulva, then they, you know, if they can label that or point to it or show, they're going to be able to get help to fix that. Or if something happens, you know, unfortunately, like somebody having like unsafe touch of any part of their body, but particularly their genitals, that they could tell somebody else about it. So I think about those as like health and safety skills for sure are kind of like two key things. And just like general, like independence skills, I think are another area that I focus on a lot, making sure that people, can do things that we'd think about as requiring privacy, like toilet training, getting dressed, bathing, those kinds of things. And the social stuff too is harder to teach, right? As like behavior analysts, we know that like some things are easier to teach than others. And certainly things with like a black and white answer, right? Like no one's allowed to touch your private body parts unless it's, I usually say, for wiping, washing, or help when hurt. So that's a tip for families. Those are my three, those are my three rules that I usually say, but yeah, so I think that those things are easier to teach, but social skills are really hard to teach. And there's so many things that can, you know, like if this happens, then this, and if this happens, then that. And it gets more and more complicated as people get older. So that's part of it as well. But those are some things that I think about starting with towards those values of happy, healthy, and safe.
Yeah, and then I would imagine similar experiences between what you've seen in the field and maybe what I have is that a lot of those young kids that grew up have developed into adults with wonderful relationships and sometimes are married, sometimes have children. I mean, it's a spectrum for a reason, is that people experience the multitude of the opportunities in life based off of where or what they can achieve at any given time. But let's stick on that concept of happy, healthy, and safe. And maybe you can give me some of the ideas of, you know, how you would tackle some of these issues or how you would look at them. And I guess I'm going to start with happy because, like you said, a lot of people default to kind of that sexual education to just being sex. But when I think of happiness, I'm also thinking about that emotional safety of a relationship, of being able to put your guard down when it's appropriate or have your guard up and kind of keep that boundary when necessary and where you can form that more intimate relationship. Is that a piece that you're working on? Is that a piece that you tackle with families as far as how do you establish healthy relationships where you can tear down some of those walls and be a little bit more vulnerable?
And I mean, I think a lot of that depends on like the, obviously the age of the person. So the, you know, the child, or if it's like a family, you know, if they're really young versus, you know, preteen, teen, older, I work with, some young adults as well. So that it really depends. And that's true for when people think about, I think also sexual health education, people think, oh, they're too young to get this information. It's like, what's really all geared to what does this person need at this point in their life, right? And how to make it age appropriate. So we're not teaching things that teenagers should know or learn about to like young kids, right? We wouldn't do that with, you know, any sort of skill. And so sexual health is part of that as well. So if I kind of like follow like chronologically for just some ideas or how I would kind of teach some of those things for young kids, I think like teaching about sort of like happy, healthy relationships. And if we're working to support somebody who needs sort of like fairly high support needs and doesn't learn as well from just like a verbally stated rule, right? So like, you know, somebody should ask before hugging you, right? As a way to, that is a signal of like a healthy relationship because someone's respecting you. But if just saying that verbally is like, well, my kid doesn't really learn through just these stated rules. They need practice, right? They need to experience that thing again and again. Is like, I think that the biggest thing to focus on then is like, how do we model as adults and other people in a child's life, what we would expect out of a healthy relationship? And so, especially if it's things like body boundaries or respecting somebody's boundaries, even if it's not about bodies, is that sort of like asking, right? And obviously what asking looks like is going to be different depending on language skills and all of those things. But is that I find often we focus a lot on the person that's neurodivergent or autistic and say, you know, oh, we're going to teach them to ask other people, ask before you touch or ask before you come close to or ask before you start talking about your favorite subject, right? Because we're trying to teach them that like a healthy relationship is this sort of give and take. We're both sort of willing to check in with each other. But then we often forget to do the flip side of that, right? Which is the like, we should also be asking like, hey, is it okay if I hug you? Hey, is it okay if I come sit closer to you? Hey, is it okay if we talk about this thing that I need to talk about right now before we talk about whatever, name whatever sort of special interest that somebody has? And so by doing those kinds of things, families and professionals can really model that like a healthy relationship is this back and forth. And there's some negotiation there too, right? So like, okay, can we spend 2 minutes talking about my thing? And then you can info dump your stuff about, right? And so, and if people are listening and able to do that back and forth, that's teaching people that that's the kind of relationship that we want to have. Not somebody who's like, you have to do this, you have to do it now. Families, obviously, there's always exceptions, right? So there's things where like health and safety, like you do have to set boundaries. but I think those, that kind of modeling, especially for younger kids, is really important. And I think as people get older, I teach them a lot, and this is true for younger kids too, of, and something that a lot of I know students that I've supported have difficulty kind of tuning into what their body's telling them, right? So they start to not pay attention to the fact that their body's telling them no or their body's saying yes, and they learn that what they have to do is just what somebody else wants, right? And so that's creating some like vulnerability, and that doesn't create a healthy relationship, both in terms of friendships. So like if you think I have to do whatever somebody else says in order to keep a friend, that's actually not a very good friend, right? And then we could extend that to like romantic or like kind of sweetheart relationships. Like if somebody's telling you that you have to do whatever they want and to keep your romantic relationship or friendship or even family relationships, like those just, that just means that that's unhealthy. So it's about teaching some of those things in a lot of different ways, and then respecting that person's boundaries too when they have them.
Yeah, I mean, your focus on modeling, I think, is spot on. I mean, when I look at some of the challenges that I sometimes see out there with adults who are either providing treatment or working with children who identify autistic, is that sometimes they're not always modeling what would be behavior that would be acceptable socially. So maybe having a 10-year-old sitting on your lap and cuddling, it's, well, is there another way that that 10-year-old can get an appropriate touch or can get a proprioceptive input in a different way than going and holding on to people maybe he's not familiar with or she's not familiar with? And it leads to potential situations where there is more risk, there is more potential for harm. Is that some of the safety parts when we're talking about the community? Is that we're trying to be able to address with children early, and then the skills get more adept as life goes on, but how to be able to be in control of an environment as well?
Yeah, I think so. And a lot of that is just that sort of communication. And from a behavior analyst perspective, you know, we might think about, you know, if there's something that somebody's doing and it's something that we don't want to see. Now, you know, I think we have to think carefully about the reasons why we don't. That should be important for that person, right? It's dangerous for them. It's creating risk, not just because it's annoying to somebody else. But when we think about those things, you know, what we would sort of do is say, okay, that person, we want to change. We don't want them to get reinforced for that or get what they're getting out of it. We need to sort of change that somehow. But that applies to things that we might do accidentally, right? So if somebody's saying, no, I don't want to do this thing, and they learn that, like, it doesn't matter what you think, or somebody else gets to decide when your no matters and when it doesn't, it's just like people just kind of stop saying no and then just go along with whatever. And I've seen that turn into pretty dangerous situations for people in terms of like relationships. So again, that being taken advantage of by, you know, people that might be in like the same school or classroom setting, in other kind of community spaces, that can be dangerous. But it also means that that person has sort of taken away that idea of having choice, right? And so being able to sort of say what a person, you know, wants more of or less of, and having some level of choice and control over their environment shows that they're able to kind of protect their own sort of safety, which I think is really important as well. Yeah, and really that kind of both ways. But it's hard because I also see examples where even families are like, all right, we're on it. We've got new family rules. And I usually tell families to say things like, or think about it as like, it doesn't mean you have to change everything that's valuable to your family, but you can just sort of think like, okay, our kids are getting older. And as kids get older, families' rules tend to shift and change. So you're just thinking about, you know, now instead of like hugging in public, that's going to be something that we just do at home or something like that. And I think there's lots of cultural reasons why people are using various types of physical touch that I also talk with families a lot about, of like what's important to you kind of culturally. I think that that's important to acknowledge as well. But even if families have sort of decided, all right, we're shifting, and I recognize that, you know, we kind of do need to make sure that they're finding other ways to get this sort of physical input from a hug, for example. But then there's all these people in the community that will just like will approach people with disabilities because they see them again as like, you know, smaller children. I see this a lot for people with Down syndrome, unfortunately, this stereotype of being just like very like friendly, social, and like really treated like children, even when they're not, and like giving hugs or also saying that it's okay. It's just so-and-so, and that's they have fill in the blank disability. And so they allow these sort of like transgressions that they wouldn't allow in other places. And I feel like it's really sending very confusing messages to some of the people that I support around like, wait, when am I allowed to hug someone? Because I went up and hugged that random lady in the grocery store and she was like, oh, it's okay, I'm a grandma, and oh, isn't he cute, and oh, he's just learning. And it's like, no, like, no. It's just say no. Like, so it's really hard. And right, I think it's important for professionals and self-advocates or families to recognize that like some of these things are complicated and you've got all of these factors. So like, don't be too kind of like down on yourself if you've done like all of this work to get your child to, you know, stop saying body part words out loud in inopportune times, and then some lady at the grocery store kind of has a big reaction about it, right? It can be tough.
Yeah, I mean, I'm listening to everything you're saying, and I'm hearing like how challenging it's got to be for a family. Is that you're teaching, you know, neurodiversity affirming care. You're teaching how to assent and consent at the same time. I mean, you're teaching social rules and socially valid sort of experiences. And you're trying to be able to navigate this scale of, you know, when do I do which? How do I navigate it? Right? There's no textbook for this. So, I mean, when you're talking to a family and you're looking at, you know, how in the world do I even approach this? Because if they don't, there is a definite risk for harm. Is where do you start in helping them to understand their own priorities? Because obviously we can't just force our own beliefs onto a family. It's got to be something that they're engaging in. So what's that process look like?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I often go back to that sort of like values conversation of like, well, what are the things that are sort of important to you as a family and help, or what do you want for your child, and that to kind of help to inform the goals that we would have. In my work, unfortunately, I don't have the position often of being the person who's in charge of the preventative teaching. I unfortunately am often in the position of being the person that's called when something has gone sideways. So often families then will have a very clear priority because it's like, well, you know, they got in trouble at school because they didn't realize that they couldn't talk about, you know, sex with this group of peers that they overheard having a conversation, but their relationship is different than the relationship of that small group of kids that was maybe having that like age appropriate talk. And now they're in trouble because that made the other people feel uncomfortable, or, and that's just like as an example. So sometimes families will come with like a very specific priority of like, these are the things that we want you to help with this thing. But then often it usually is like the skills are often, very often, not related to sexual health sometimes in a lot of ways, right? So it's sort of like, well, what other opportunities does your child have for, you know, building those appropriate social relationships? Because having like peers, especially for teenagers, having peers as a group to learn a bit, is it the best that teens are learning from other teens about sexual health? Sometimes not. But the reality is that that's how a lot of kids start to learn or understand like social rules. And so if your child doesn't have a social network or an extensive social network, or their social network is mostly online versus offline, sort of like, what are you doing to develop some of those skills that are going to help them to have those communities where they can have those conversations about sexual health or bodies or relationships, right? And that find out in like ways like other kids. And then I will often ask families, particularly like I live in a fairly like multicultural sort of city, and I do consultation with like other communities around me. And so I will ask questions about like culturally or religion, like some of those variables for families. Like, is there anything that's very important for you to communicate to your child? Or is there something about, you know, religious or cultural beliefs or background that means that like you've not had these conversations? And then usually I'll work with families to almost like behavior analysts would know, it's like a task analysis of saying, okay, so we've got this skill at the end, which is like your child is indicating that they want to have a sexual relationship with somebody else. This is again like somebody that would be like a teen that I'm working with. So, okay, they've stated that that's something that they want, but they're missing some skills, right, to do that safely. But you're saying that, you know, values for your family mean you would prefer that that happens after they're married. Okay, so how do we communicate to your child? How do they make that decision? Why is that important to your family? If they do wait until they're married, they still need to understand what having a sexual relationship with somebody else might mean in terms of pregnancy, if that's the kind of sex that they're having. So there's still lots of things that we could work on to get there that isn't necessarily saying, here, I'm going to teach your child how to date and find a sexual relationship, right? There's lots of kind of building blocks, and that can often families feel more comfortable if we're thinking about the steps to get somewhere safely. And so some of those things are things that I'll ask families about for sure. And I do get some families that ask about preventative sexual health information or education, and they're saying that's because they want their child to have more healthy relationships than they did, or they want their child to have information that they know is important that they didn't, or they've heard that disabled people are more vulnerable in terms of abuse or exploitation, so they want to make sure that their kid is safe. And so families are often coming to me with a really solid sort of goal of like what they want long term, and then my job is just to kind of break down like, well, what do they need to get there?
Yeah. And I mean, and you've reiterated several times is that physical sexual interaction or sexual intercourse isn't something that, I mean, it's taught maybe at young adulthood or whenever. But I'd love to hear your opinion on some of the barriers that exist right now on some of those relationship building skills, some of those consensual skills, some of those being able to assert oneself, because oftentimes is that these are skills that are limited in schools. It's hard for families to be able to navigate some of these questions with a neurotypical child, and let alone somebody who might need a little bit more tailored responses or more modeling or more examples into it. So where in the community should we be beefing things up a little bit to give that support? Because families can't be on an island on this.
Yeah. Yeah. And I find that like when you're sort of saying like asking about barriers, again, I sort of have the privilege, or my position is such that like people usually like reach out to me because they recognize that they need support, or their child needs support, or a student of theirs needs support. And so I am also recognize that I'm getting a bit of like a sampling bias of like people who are okay with talking about the topic will often come to me, or I'll work with, because they're comfortable talking about it. And I don't know that I'm necessarily connecting with the families that are not, right, are not comfortable talking about it, or don't know what to say or do. But I think that the bigger barrier there, in my experience, is not that families don't want to acknowledge that this is an important area. It's that families don't have, parents don't have good sexual health education themselves, right? So if you don't have information and you don't feel like you can talk to, and again, like the child, neurotypical, neurodivergent, it doesn't matter. If you don't feel like you have the information, then you definitely don't feel like you can take that information and make it then like age appropriate for your child, or adapt it for your child who has a language disability, or has difficulty communicating in different ways. And so I think that the biggest barrier is like lack of sexual health education for the people who are meant to now be the teachers, right? It's not in a lot of like parenting books or classes and like those sorts of things, right? So that I think is like the biggest barrier. And so I usually say, like, for parents, that first thing to think about is like, where can you get information, or for you to just even be more comfortable yourself talking about it, or if it's two parents in a family, sort of like, can you have a conversation, you know, yourself and your parenting partner or partner, like partner, spouse, whatever, about like, what are the values that you have for your kids around this? Because if then can you teach them, right? So having those conversations adult to adult is also can feel really scary, but is like a good thing to sort of check in about. So yeah, lack of sexual health education. There's some good resources in that area. I would say like a great Instagram account for people to follow, and they have a great book, is called Sex Positive Families. They're excellent in terms of small bits of sexual health information of like, here's a topic, here's a short thing that you could say to a kid. Now, most of that is not, you know, geared towards parents who are parenting somebody with a disability, but at least if you get comfortable with the idea of like, okay, here's the information, you can figure out how could I translate that, or I could ask my child's support team of like, I think this bit of information is important, how could we take that and show it to them, or have them learn it in a way that's accessible. But yeah, the biggest barrier is just like not having information, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard. And even that information piece, when we're talking about heterosexual relationships, there's probably more. But mm-hmm. when you're talking about people that have different sexual identity than a heterosexual relationship, now you're talking about a lack, even more lacking resources and less discussion about it. But there's not a reduction in the percentage of people who identify autistic who fit a different sexual identity mm-hmm. than that. So where are the resources for people to go out and learn and to be able to have a more inclusive conversation so that their child isn't necessarily told what to think, but is told, you know, how to process some of these feelings that might be coming out?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, and I think a lot of like some of that work tends to be work that like I do or other people in the space is taking some resources and doing that sort of conversion. Cause you've got these sort of multiple identities, right? So you've got, you know, a child who's neurodivergent or autistic, and then they're also maybe indicating that they're somewhere in the LGBTQ spectrum, and families are saying like, I want to support this, but where are the resources for my child for that? And it's tough. There's not a lot of great resources. There are a few. There's a really lovely resource from the Organization for Autism Research that's called Sex Ed for Self-Advocates that starts with things as easy as like public and private and goes all the way up to stuff like dating and like sexual consent. And I like that resource because it's made with and for collaboration with some autistic self-advocates who also do work in the area of sexual health. So that's a really great resource. I would say that it has lots of great information, but if you need sort of like materials to help, like if your child's more of a learn through doing or like learn through pictures and those sorts of things, it can be like a little bit more challenging for sure to find some of that information. But I do really like that resource. If people are just wondering like, my kid is 8, What does an eight-year-old need to know? One resource that I think is really great. I'm in Canada, so it's a Canadian resource, but it's it would be helpful for sort of any audience, American or international, which is teachingsexualhealth.ca, and they have a really great age by age. So you can be like, my child is this age. What should they be learning about? What should they know? So you can sort of cross-reference of like, oh yeah, my child does know that, or how could I teach that to my child? And they do have a small section as well for helping families and teachers, teaching people with disabilities. And they've got some ideas for some different things like that. If you've got a kid who just like won't learn anything if it's not on YouTube, I've worked with some of those kids and families before. There's a great website that links to YouTube videos called amaze.org, and they've got little short cartoon versions. They've got some for really little kids, and then they've got some for older teens, and they're just like 3 to 5 minute YouTube videos that are helpful to go through. And I've watched those with clients and talk about them, and I've had parents do that with their kids too. Sometimes the language can be like a little bit more complex, and so again, they need to be sort of like broken down into smaller pieces. But some of those resources are great places for people to go to just get information.
Yeah. And I mean, you just spoke about the use of YouTube, and I mean, it brings to life the idea of all the media that's out there, social media that's out there. If we're not teaching our children the appropriate ways to be able to explore their own sexuality from kind of, I mean, developmentally when it's appropriate for them, we are going to run the risk that they're going to look for it themselves. And you've said already, as we've been chatting, modeling is one of the kind of ways that it's taught. I mean, what are the safety precautions that families need to be aware of that, you know, internet is a big one, but I mean, mm-hmm. what are some of the safety precautions that we need to worry about, you know, self-education on some of these ideas versus being able to control the narrative at times to be able to give the information that is important for that stage of life or that that journey the child might and young adult might be going through?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, such a huge, huge area. I mean, I feel like I could work just in the realm of like online sexual health wellness and safety, probably. So a few things that I usually think about is, you're exactly right, is that if we don't provide information, or if we think, oh, my child is autistic or has a disability, and so they're not going to be interested, is that even if they're not interested, it doesn't take very long for like kids to hear other kids use words at school or something that they don't know. So if they don't know what, you know, penises or boobs are or sexes, you know, and not in graphic detail, but just enough for people to know when two people say yes to, you know, sharing their bodies together, we could, that could be a definition of sex that would be age appropriate for like younger people. Is that if they hear those words or think or see them somewhere else, it is pretty easy to just Google, right? Of like what, like, or boob, you know, penis, sex, those are pretty easily Googleable. You know, and if you've got a child that is online, you know, for most people, their youth, particularly, I've worked with some youth that like they spend a lot of their time online, or their technology, they're quite adept, right? They're more skilled than their parents at using technology. Is that they're going to, if they don't have the information somewhere else, they're going to find it, right? And online is kind of one way. So I encourage families to have like books available as like a safer place to learn about bodies, even if it's just looking at the pictures. You know, if your child isn't a sit down and read a book kind of kid, that's totally fine. A shameless plug of my podcast, I have a podcast called Sex Ed Book Review, where we talk about different sexual health books that are good for different ages, what we like about them, don't like, and give some ideas for how parents can, or supports, teachers, things like that, can take the content from the books and use it with a neurodivergent audience. And so there's lots of books that are available. That's important. I think a lot, one thing that I when I talk about online spaces and learning, is that there's a real sort of impulse on the part of parents to be like, well, we'll just shut it down. We'll put on parent filters, and we'll monitor their device, or we'll take away their device. And I support parental monitoring, and you should really have a good idea of like where your child's going online, particularly because like most people are only more than like a few clicks away from something that could be like, if not pornographic, then sexually explicit, or using language that would be inappropriate to use outside of, you know, you know, like a close friend or like comedy space. So that, I do think that that's important, but I always say like, we can't just not do the education then. So if you're going to have like monitoring and those things, you do also need to make sure that your child's having access to some kind of education. I caution parents a lot, particularly of teens, and I've seen a lot of teens that I work with that are autistic that have struggled for a lot of their lives with those in-person social skills, right? It can be really challenging. They can find communities online that are interested in some of the same things as them, and those online relationships are really valuable to them, and they can, it's a real source of connection that can, you know, there's obviously pros and cons to online and offline relationships. Both can be toxic and harmful. So we need to teach, again, some of that relationship sort of stuff. But I caution parents against removing devices entirely, because I've seen this turn into that sends the message that like, if I see something that I feel like I don't understand what I'm looking at, or if somebody's being unsafe towards me, or I think somebody's being tricky, I can't tell my family, because then they'll take away my connection to my social community. So then it starts to just become more and more secretive. And I think that that's not different for neurotypical families, but I have definitely seen lots of clients that I support where online communities are easier for them to access, and maybe more valuable for them for a variety of different reasons. And so I see that happening a lot. So it's really a balance of like putting in those safeguards and safety measures. And I think having open conversations with teens if they're able to, right? But I've also worked with lots of people who are like highly impacted by their disability, but they have access to an iPad, YouTube, there's not filters placed on it, and they've found pornography pretty easily. So, you know, like just, you know, the people that aren't, that really aren't even typing in search terms. It's just kind of click, 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 click. That video looks cool. And then YouTube feeds you stuff. And then you click on something and it takes you to a website off YouTube. And like 10 clicks, your now teen who doesn't understand what they're looking at, or youth who doesn't understand what they're looking at, has found pornography. And so definitely making sure that we're aware of what people are looking at online. And then that can become problematic because they don't know what they're looking at and they show it to somebody else, or they don't know what they're looking at and it's sexually exciting. And then they're, you know, engaging in sexual behaviors in public places. So it's like all kinds of risk that can flow from that.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm so happy that you emphasize the open conversation piece, because it's not just the pornographic or sexually explicit material. A lot of times relationships are modeled in movies. They're modeled in these cartoons that they're watching. And these are not models that you'd want to follow for relationships 95% of the time. I mean, they're out there to be able to generate more views and for people to watch these shows, which is not the normal boring relationship. That is a loving, caring relationship that exists. So I do think those open conversations are so important. Which leads to the fact that you mentioned your podcast, you mentioned the Autism Resource Network. Are there other resources, or how do people get more in touch with your type of services or your services specifically that they can help to educate themselves on to have these conversations?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely, I feel like there's more and more of this starting to be available in lots of different spaces. I do a fair amount of like consultation with like families or teams around, like, if you're wanting to teach something, here's the ways that some of this might be able to be taught. I do have like some, I'm trying to slowly build up a library of resources available on my website to help people teach some of these things. So I can send you that link, but it's positiveconnections.ca, because again, I'm in Canada. And then there's a resources page, and on that page I have some materials, which I find is the hardest thing. Like, so sometimes you can go onto websites and say like, okay, like people need to learn like public and private places, but like, okay, now, like, then what? This place is public, this place is private. So, like, on my website, I have, like, some pictures of public and private places and, like, a little tip sheet that's, like, here's how you could teach people about public or private or semi-private places. I've got other ones, a lot around, like, puberty stuff, so helping to teach, like, menstrual management and care. I've got some resources for that. Erection management, so if somebody is entering puberty and they're getting erections, which often are spontaneous. But if people that I've supported that don't really have the same level of social awareness of sort of like what's expected and not. So I've got some resources there of like some good ideas and some not so good ideas for like when somebody gets an erection or how to manage them if they're happening in public. And so I'm trying to like eventually like add more stuff there, because that's what I find is for the most part people have an idea of what to teach, but they're not sure how to teach it. Or they don't have the resources. But one thing that I often suggest to families or professionals is like, think about how your child learns any other skill. It doesn't matter. Like, pick something like loading the dishwasher. Did you teach them to load the dishwasher? Great. How did you do it? Oh, like we made a video of their older sister loading the dishwasher and they watched it a couple times. And so they learned how to load our family dishwasher. It's like, great. Your kid knows how to learn from video models. So can we find some like video models? Again, those are pretty complicated to find for particularly like sexual health and like hygiene kind of routines for people. I've got some of those on my website that don't include real bodies. They include like sort of like stand-ins. But like if your child learns from videos or like videos of social interactions, right, then that might be a good way to focus on that. Or if they learn from visuals or having a script or something like that, kind of like, you know, I think we sort of think, well, this has something to do with sexual health and bodies. And so it just sort of we forget how teaching happens or how learning happens for like our kid. And it's like, well, think about how they learn and then try to find ways to teach these skills in the same way as well, I think is important for sure.
Well, Linda, I appreciate the way that you go about this. It's taking any sort of shame out of the process and really creating empowerment to it around sexual health education. So I truly appreciate the work that you've done, and thank you for coming onto the podcast today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This was great. I hope that people found a couple nuggets of information or something that can be helpful for them. I think, again, we talked about it before, but the biggest thing is just becoming more comfortable yourself. And so whenever I'm on a podcast or something like this and we sort of get to the end, I think like if a family's listening and they made it this far, it's like, you did it. You did the first step, right? You listened, you got some ideas, you heard something that might apply to your kid or some stuff that doesn't apply right now. And like, that's an amazing first start, is just being open to hearing the conversation.
No, thanks again. Thank you for listening to Autism Weekly. We hope you tune back in next week to learn more about autism in the real world. Autism Weekly is now found on all the major listening apps, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Subscribe to be notified when we post a new podcast. Autism Weekly is produced by ABS Kids. ABS Kids is proud to provide diagnostic assessments and ABA therapy to children with developmental delays like autism spectrum disorder. You can learn more about ABS Kids and the Autism Weekly podcast by visiting abskids.com. Thanks for tuning in. See you again next week.